From feature story news in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. And coming up on today's programme, alongside the very latest news from Capitol Hill, we bring you the global reaction to the shutdown debt crisis agreement and examine the domestic and economic pain inflicted by the near three-week standoff. Find out why the US government is getting tough on food safety standards following dozens of deaths which were linked to contaminated produce in Colorado, and discover why Britain is banking on China and why that new relationship has already come in for some seriously strong international criticism. And we take an in-depth look into the alarming rate of tuberculosis sweeping through the population of California. That's all ahead on FSN Reports, after a summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Simon Marks.
The American people are completely fed up with Washington.
President Obama speaking at the White House after hundreds of thousands of federal government workers returned to their posts and the country avoided its date with the debt ceiling. The president urged Republicans to work with him in the months ahead on budget negotiations, immigration reform, and a farm bill. From FSN's Washington Bureau, Priscilla Huff has more.
U.S. President Barack Obama says the political crisis of the past few weeks has caused unnecessary damage to the American economy, and it's time for politics to change in Washington.
And there's no good reason why we can't govern responsibly, despite our differences.
Forecasters say the crisis over funding the American government and extending the debt ceiling has cost the economy between $12 and $24 billion.
Also today, President Obama congratulated the newest member of the U.S. Senate, Democrat Cory Booker. The former mayor of Newark in New Jersey won a special election in the state to swell the Democrats' ranks on Capitol Hill. He is a rising star in the party. Closed-circuit television footage has been made public showing the brutality of last month's Al-Shabaab attack on the Westgate shopping mall in Nairobi. It shows the horrified reaction of shoppers as the complex first came under fire. Meanwhile, the U.S. Embassy in Kampala is warning of another attack modelled on the Westgate siege. FSN's Isabel Nakiria reports from our bureau in the Ugandan capital.
The U.S. mission in Kampala says it's continuing to assess reports that a Westgate-style attack could take place soon in Kampala. In a statement, it says there is no further information on timing or location of when terrorists might strike Kampala. Uganda Police spokesperson Patrick Onyango says they are responding to the U.S. warning.
We are urging the public not to panic because we are here to protect them.
The U.S. mission in Kampala is also warning its citizens in Uganda to be vigilant and to avoid public venues that attract large crowds.
Chemical weapons inspectors in Syria say they've completed almost half their work dismantling the country's stockpile of chemical weapons, but security for the inspectors remains a major issue. There have been several bomb blasts near the Damascus Hotel where they're staying. The World Health Organization says it has conclusive proof that outdoor air pollution is linked to human deaths from cancer. The International Agency for Research on Cancer released findings of a new study at a meeting in the French city of Lyon on Thursday. Dr. Kurt Strafe of the agency says 40 years of study have gone into the findings.
There have been more than 950 agents that have been evaluated, and more than 100 of these have been classified as carcinogenic to humans, meaning we know that it's causing cancer in humans.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Britain has announced a deal to allow Chinese companies to take a stake in British nuclear power plants. The controversial plan could see Chinese firms owning majority stakes in some of Britain's most important strategic assets. From FSN's London bureau, Ollie Barrett reports.
The first actual deal with Chinese involvement could come as early as next week, when the go-ahead's expected to be given for a new £14 billion, $22 billion nuclear plant for the UK. George Osborne has signed a Memorandum of Understanding with China on nuclear cooperation. An accompanying statement says over time, Chinese companies could come to take majority stakes in British power stations. The policy will be controversial, with environmentalists insisting the UK should be pursuing pursuing greener, less dangerous technology, and questions being raised about the wisdom of allowing China to potentially control British nuclear power stations.
Thursday was another busy day for Australia's firefighters in New South Wales, where bushfires are causing havoc with strong winds and high temperatures across parts of the state. From Melbourne, Arthur Stevens reports.
Bushfires have stretched the New South Wales Rural Fire Service to the limit as temperatures soared in and around Sydney. Police say a fast-moving bushfire at Springwood is affecting areas near Penrith at the foot of the Blue Mountains west of Sydney. The fire has jumped the Nepean River and is also burning in Castlereagh just north of Penrith. To the north of Sydney, a Newcastle airport's been closed and staff sent home because of a bushfire nearby at Heatherbrae. An airport spokesman says it will remain closed indefinitely, but may reopen on Friday depending on the wind direction. The strong winds have also cut power to thousands of homes to the west, southwest and north of Sydney. Arthur Stevens, Melbourne.
There's more from us on Twitter. You can follow us there at Feature Story and see our reporting at fsnreportersblog.com. And that is the latest Feature Story news. Simon Marks reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports. We begin today with the shutdown of the shutdown and the averted debt crisis after Congress finally came together to bring an end to 16 days of political turmoil. The fear now, Washington could be heading for a rerun of the deadlock and brinkmanship early next year. From Capitol Hill, Alice Ulstein reports on a tortuous 24 hours.
The government reopened today after both chambers of Congress passed a temporary funding bill and the president signed it into law. Many members of Congress made long speeches Wednesday, congratulating and thanking one another for ending the 16-day-long shutdown, and left the vote smiling and laughing. But Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin said there's little to celebrate, considering the shutdown cost the economy an estimated $24 billion.
A lot of damage has been done. I can show you small businesses that aren't going to reopen. I can show you people whose anxiety levels are through the roof. Our economy has been hurt. No question harm's been done. We've got to repair it.
The bill funds the government through mid-January and raises the debt ceiling through early February. It also requires the House and Senate to immediately begin work on a long-term budget in a conference committee led by Washington Democrat Patty Murray and Wisconsin Republican Paul Ryan. The two had breakfast Thursday morning to kick off the negotiations, which must conclude by mid-December. Many Republicans said they hope to win further deep cuts to government spending in these negotiations, especially to support programs like Social Security and Medicare, while some Democrats say they'll push to undo some of the deep cuts already made to the nation's funding for infrastructure, education, and research. With such opposing priorities, many expressed concern that the conference would not be able to reach an agreement on a budget by its deadline, raising the threat of yet another government shutdown and debt ceiling standoff in early 2014.
I think it would be a great American tragedy if we had the same thing happen in 3 or 4 months.
That's California Democrat Dianne Feinstein. She said she hopes her colleagues are more motivated to work out their differences now, knowing this shutdown has hurt the American people more than the last one did in 1996.
17 years ago, as many people weren't working paycheck to paycheck. Secondly, now you have more families where the mother and the father must work, and the salary of one often doesn't cover the mortgage. So what we've had, particularly from California, a number of people saying, I'm not going to be able to cover my mortgage. What's going to happen to me? I've had people saying, well, I can't pay my rent. I'm going to be evicted. We shouldn't do that to people.
Because past bipartisan conferences have failed to meet their deadlines, including the 2011 Super Committee, lawmakers expressed anxiety about the prospects for this round of negotiations. But Arizona Republican John McCain said the damage to his party from the shutdown should pressure representatives to compromise.
The one thing that politicians want is approval from the people. They strongly disapprove of all of us. They just disapprove of Republicans more. So hopefully we learn the lesson not to do this.
Speaking at the White House Thursday, President Obama listed further impacts of the shutdown that his agencies have documented, including a widespread dip in consumer spending and a subsequent decision by half of all CEOs in the U.S. to put off hiring new workers.
Let's be clear. There are no winners here. These last few weeks have inflicted completely unnecessary damage on our economy. We don't know yet the full scope of the damage, but every analyst out there believes it slowed our growth.
He scolded members of Congress and urged them to work together now on a long-term budget, pass immigration reform, and hammer out a farm bill. In Washington, I'm Alice Olstein.
Now the government shutdown may be officially over, but across America, furloughed workers and government suppliers are counting the cost of 2.5 weeks of limbo. And the city that played host to all the political wrangling isn't immune. In particular, its tourist industry. Washington, D.C.'s mayor, Vincent Gray, says 13,000 fewer hotel rooms were booked than this time last year. Lorna Shaddick takes a look at how the arguments on Capitol Hill affected the city surrounding it.
2 weeks into the government shutdown, the queues were growing at Washington's International Spy Museum. The private attraction stayed open throughout, drawing visitors who may otherwise have been heading for the nearby mall and the many free Smithsonian institutions. So business was booming. Here's manager Jason Worden.
Over the past 2 weeks, we've certainly seen an influx in visitors due to the government shutdown. We're certainly very fortunate that being a private institution that our doors remain open, but we know a number of our neighbors aren't. And I think over time it's certainly going to have a negative effect on the city overall, even if in the short term it is helping a few private institutions.
Although things are looking good for the Spy Museum itself, some of those who've been visiting found the shutdown confusing and disappointing, especially those who were expecting to visit free attractions and have now ended up paying.
We planned on going to the Smithsonian. We've been saving up for probably about a year, and we didn't expect this. I'm kind of angry. We spent quite a lot of money to come flying out here.
We were pretty disappointed. We couldn't see the things we want to see. We want to see a lot of the things that are now shut down.
We spent a lot of money on plane tickets, and now we're not really getting the benefit of the city.
That confusion has translated into a lot of lost business for Washington, D.C., at a time of year when custom is already low, and the city itself also loses out on sales tax as a result. Barbara Lang is head of the city's Chamber of Commerce.
Tourism is down by almost 8%. Tax revenue from restaurants and hotels is down 78% as well. There are 13,000 less hotel bookings than we would normally have this time. So absolutely, it has had a negative impact.
And she says for many, that lost revenue isn't recoverable.
Even when the government goes back to work, these restaurants and your small retail shops and your large retail shops, that money is gone. And so they cannot recover that. And so the District of Columbia government also will not be able to get the sales tax revenue that they have lost. So that is just gone.
Downtown D.C. is seemingly at the end of a long, dark shutdown tunnel, but its museums, restaurants and shops have taken a big financial hit. And for many of them, there's no way to recover what's been lost during the infighting on nearby Capitol Hill. Lorna Shaddick, Washington.
So, how is the news of the compromise struck in Washington playing around the world? FSN's Simon Marks spoke to Ollie Barrett, our bureau chief in London, Anya Ideyeva, FSN's Moscow bureau chief, and Gary Alfonso, who heads our bureau in Johannesburg, South Africa. And he started by asking Ollie Barrett in London about reaction in the UK to news of the agreement that kicks America's political standoff down the road.
Yeah, I think the one word you can really use to describe the way people have been reacting to what they've been seeing unfolding in Washington is incredulity. People just don't understand why things have unfolded in this way. People really do not understand, because the political system here is very different, obviously, why on earth there should be this seemingly ongoing, every few months, row and standoff about the debt ceiling, about the budget. And they certainly don't understand why this time around it seemed to be linked in some way to Obamacare, to President Obama's healthcare reforms. People are really scratching their heads to try and work out what's been going on and why it's been unfolding in this way. As I say, the system here, very different. We don't have these ongoing debates and discussions and therefore negotiations about the budget. And so people here who are interested in US politics and who feel very fondly about the Americans have really been just looking on aghast, wondering why it comes to this and seems to come to this over and over again. And you talk about kicking the can down the road. One person I spoke to earlier here put it this way. He described it as hitting the snooze button over and over again.
Indeed. And Anya Ardayeva in Moscow, all of this comes at a time when Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, has been trying to project himself as a global leader running a global power. Does this crisis in Washington play into his hands?
Well, it certainly does. Vladimir Putin said on October 8th that Russia is very interested to see the U.S. economy recovering because he says it's the biggest economy in the world and the state that it's in affects the entire world. And the country's state-run media echoed that statement, but in a slightly more critical way, saying that the shutdown damaged the image of the United States, the image that it carries of a global leader, and that this would inevitably result in investors losing their confidence and their trust in the U.S. A Russian state channel Vesti, for instance, said, quote, "How is this possible that a superpower which dictates its conditions to the entire world managed to get to the edge by failing its internal policy and bringing its economy into a dead end?" But then again, this isn't something unusual because anti-American rhetoric on state-run television has been dominating the air here for a number of years as relations between the two countries have been steadily declining. And of course, a number of pro-Kremlin voices here are questioning what is the point to have an independent parliament and independent Senate when it results in something like that, and bringing a point that it's much better to have a system that exists in Russia at the moment when the parliament and both houses of parliament are controlled and very loyal to people in the Kremlin.
And Gary Alfonso, you, of course, are in South Africa, an established democracy, but you are at the foot of a continent where there are emerging democracies and emerging economies. Does this experience of the last two or three weeks damage the credibility of the United States in the region?
I wouldn't say it damages the credibility of the United States in the region. I'd say it's much more a nervousness that's in these emerging markets because, you know, even though South Africa is one of 55 countries on the continent, the reality is that it is the biggest economy on the continent. And if the U.S. catches a cold, South Africa's, or if the U.S. sneezes, South Africa's economy catches a serious cold and the rest of the continent catches pneumonia. So I think it's a very important indicator of the fact that the South African currency has funnily enough strengthened over the past three or four weeks while this was going on, for the simple matter that South Africa relies heavily on the US buying South African infrastructure bonds. And of course that's a big policy of the National Federal Reserve in the US, is that buying foreign bonds, of which South Africa is a major benefactor, supports the South African economy and obviously also gets foreign currency into the South African economy. The downside to that is that with quantitative easing possibly changing in future because of a new federal Fed, a central Fed chairperson coming in at the end of the year and Bernanke moving on, there's no telling whether that long-term kicking of the can down the road is going to be a double whammy for the South African economy because they really depend on those infrastructure bonds, the 10 to 15 year contracts, and obviously gold is no longer the lifesaver in South Africa or anywhere else on the continent. So the only economies that really are going to be benefiting are those that are or will remain immune to U.S. buying of foreign bonds and contracts, like, for instance, Nigeria, which has huge oil reserves. So, yes, nervousness across the continent, but not so much in as much as the U.S. government not being able to function, but rather the releasing of dollars to the emerging markets.
Governing by crisis in the United States. Ollie Barrett is FSN's London Bureau Chief. Anya Ardayeva is FSN's Moscow Bureau Chief. And Gary Alfonso is FSN's Johannesburg Bureau Chief.
British Chancellor George Osborne, the UK government's financial chief, has announced a series of deals with China as he attempts to set the UK apart from its American and European allies in the hunt for Chinese cash. He's been on an extended personal trip to China, and the two countries will cooperate on a range of issues from banking to nuclear power. But eyebrows are being raised by the lengths to which the UK appears to be going to accommodate its new Chinese partners. UK correspondent Natalie Powell reports.
British Chancellor George Osborne has been attempting to show the UK is more open to Chinese business than a wary United States, and that Britain is more dynamic and less bureaucratic than the rest of Europe. So he's been telling Chinese audiences that Britain and China have much in common.
We are two great trading nations with a shared interest in keeping the trade routes of the world open and free. We are two countries that care about the world and want to influence its future direction. And yes, of course, we have differences, different political systems, we attach value to different things, and we shouldn't be afraid of pointing out where we disagree. But let us not do it in a way that is not respectful of each other.
So a deal's been struck to allow Chinese companies to take majority stakes in nuclear power plants in the UK, an arrangement probably unthinkable in the US. Visa restrictions for Chinese tourists coming to the UK are also being relaxed. And there's also a pilot deal where Chinese banks will be allowed to operate in the UK without having to face the usual regulations. Alistair McCaig, market analyst with IG Group, says it's designed to help the flow of Chinese cash into Britain.
Much like the rest of the Western world, they're very keen to get as much exposure to the Chinese markets and money as they can. And this is very much an easing of the regulations with which Chinese banks would have to meet in order to gain access to the UK markets.
Mr. Osborne hopes these latest deals will bring Britain a step closer to becoming a premier renminbi hub. It's already some way there. Earlier this year, the Bank of England became one of the first in Europe to establish a currency swap gateway with the yuan. But there has been some criticism too, that relaxing regulations is in fact bucking the trend. US bankers have attacked the Chancellor's decision to loosen these rules, calling it inconsistent and saying it is inconceivable that Chinese banks are to be given special treatment. IG's Alistair McCaig says there's a contradiction here.
Does really set a slightly lower benchmark for Chinese banks, and arguably this actually flows in the opposite direction to what US and European banks have had to do. They've actually been having to meet more stringent levels of regulatory oversight in order to facilitate business inside the UK.
On the other hand, there are some voices in London that believe Mr. Osborne's deals will have very little impact and that they are simply political measures. Richard Porteous, the president of the Centre for Economic Policy Research, is among them.
The Chancellor of the Exchequer doesn't tell people what foreign exchange trades to make. The markets decide on that, not him. It looks good for the Chancellor to come back and say, I've struck a deal, or I've made a big initiative to expand Chinese financial business in the United Kingdom. The bottom line here is that this is not going to be big business, not for many years.
Nonetheless, the British government is fond of saying that it's in a global race, and it's certainly running quickly after Chinese cash. The Chancellor hopes he can beat American and European allies to the finish line, but his critics at home and in the US worry he's giving too much away to the Chinese in return. Natalie Powell, London.
You'd be forgiven for assuming tuberculosis is a disease of the past, but in reality it's still very active, and not only in developing countries. The highest rates of TB infection in the United States can be found in California, where 2 million residents have some form of the disease. Local health authorities want to act quickly to treat patients, but they face cultural barriers and interruptions in drug supplies. Rebecca Bowering reports.
Tuberculosis remains one of the biggest killers in the world today, yet it's treatable and curable. What few people know is that the slow-growing bacteria can lie dormant in the body for decades. Margot Sidner is president of Breathe California in the Bay Area.
Years and years later, it can again become active if you are under a great deal of stress.
California has the highest incidence of TB in the US, especially in Silicon Valley. The diverse, shifting population of migrant workers, especially in the tech industry, has exacerbated the spread of the disease, which arrives from places like India, China, and Southeast Asia.
People who come from countries where they could not get treatment do not understand that TB can be cured. And some of them also don't have a custom of taking drugs, so they worry about taking the year-long therapy that's necessary to control TB.
Breathe California believes one of the best ways to do this is by educating young people, and it's been working with local schools. 9-year-old Sarah Ramaha and Jamie Watt won prizes for the posters they designed showing how TB is contracted and treated.
Even if you do take the pills and you're feeling better, you need to take them until you're good.
Patients at a clinic in San Jose are being tested for latent TB. A small amount of a common antigen is injected under the skin. If the immune system reacts within 48 hours or so, then that's a sign the patient's been exposed to tuberculosis. TB controllers like Tibal Samurai say treatment is a preventative measure, but patients aren't always keen.
I think one of the challenges that we face is oftentimes when people feel well, they don't want to be treated, and it takes a bit of convincing that they should be treated to prevent TB developing as a disease later on in life.
Another recent hurdle was problems with the distribution of a key TB medicine, isoniazid.
Those kinds of interruptions in the supply risk developing resistance in those patients and risk continuing to spread tuberculosis.
TB controllers want Congress to increase research funding for drug-resistant TB, which has previously been cut. And that's not their only concern. At the moment, holders of the H-1B work visa don't have to be screened for infectious diseases. Immigration reform could lead to a rapid increase in the US's foreign worker population, and TB controllers say without a screening program, tuberculosis rates could rocket too. Rebecca Bowring, San Jose, California.
Two cantaloupe farmers from Colorado, accused of being at the heart of a deadly 2011 outbreak of listeria, will plead guilty as part of a deal with federal prosecutors. This comes after the US Food and Drug Administration brought criminal charges last month against the two brothers. A rare move and one seen as a sign that the US is cracking down on tainted produce. FSN's Mary McCarthy reports from Rocky Ford, Colorado. Ground zero of the listeria outbreak.
Cantaloupes are the pride of the Rocky Ford farming region in southeast Colorado. So when the 2011 listeria outbreak that killed 33 people across the country was traced back here, farmers took it hard.
It just doesn't affect one person. It affected the whole cantaloupe industry. So it was a wake-up call to every farmer.
Michael Hirakata owns Hirakata Farms just outside Rocky Ford. He says when the U.S. government recently brought criminal charges against the nearby Jensen Farms, where sloppy packing procedures allegedly allowed listeria bacteria to grow, it reiterated the push for enhanced safety procedures. Now, produce farmers here say they enforce standards that go beyond what's required by law.
We've came together, and all of the members of our Rocky Ford Growers Association have to have an audit from the USDA, a third-party audit from the USDA, one announced and one unannounced.
U.S. cantaloupe farmers are required to have cleaning and rinsing equipment and are strongly encouraged to hire on-site food safety managers.
Washing involves, it's a four-step process. We use clean water, then we use it's called melon soap, and then we use an antimicrobial, it's called a selectricide.
Since the listeria outbreak, Colorado State University researchers have stepped up their programs educating local farmers about produce safety.
Microbial contamination on fresh fruits and vegetables, I think, is one of the most challenging issues facing public health today, and we don't have any perfect answers for it.
Food safety professor Marissa Bunning says that good produce safety doesn't require sophisticated technology, but rather knowledge of basic techniques to stop the spread of germs.
Trying to think about the source of possible contamination on a farm, and that might be irrigation water, it might be manure, it might be access to animals.
Even though the listeria outbreak led to improved safety procedures, melon farmers say many customers remain wary and that safety concerns are likely to plague the industry for years to come. Mary McCarthy, Rocky Ford, Colorado.
And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can tell us what you think of our program by email. Our address is reports@featurestory.com. Coming up on Friday, fears that the US could lose its global lead in biomedical research. That's Friday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington, alongside producer Simon Marks. For everyone with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.